why didn't you let me go in there with you? Perhaps my presence could have made a difference. Perhaps they would have had some pity on us if they could just see me. Perhaps they wouldn't have responded the way that they did if they saw all of us, all of the lives that would be affected. This was the logic of an 11-year-old me pleading the case to my mom to let me advocate for her in the highest stakes of her life, of my life. I guess I've always been a bit unreasonably confident, but I really did want to be in that room. But she told me I couldn't go in. In fact, none of us could go with her, just her and the lawyer. See, here's the story. We had been in this country for about a decade, and it finally cleared the first hurdle, dropping the requirement, forcing us to go back to war-torn Liberia because of my dad's student visa that we came here on. And now my mom was eligible to apply for political asylum. So I really wanted to be in the room with her as she made that case. But we couldn't. So we sat in the parking lot of that immigration office in Houston, Texas, waiting for my mom to return. Finally, she came out. What did he say to you? She said he listened carefully as she told the stories of the hardships we suffered, of being at the point of death many times. But ultimately, she said, he concluded that she didn't suffer because of politics. She wasn't a major political figure or a member of a group that was explicitly targeted for political purposes. She was targeted in fear for her life. He agreed, but she didn't meet the political standards that he was looking for. And while he could grant her political asylum, he wouldn't. He would let her make a decision, he said. She could either plead her case to another judge and, if denied, be deported and all of us along with her, or continue to live year to year under TPS. And as she told the stories, her eyes swelled and we all got teary. What did you decide, my sister? We'll decide that we'll keep living year to year. We can't risk your stability. We can't risk your lives. I push back. No, Mom, I'm tired of the fearfulness. You should have gone before that other judge. Go before that other judge. No, my mom pushed back. Elijah, we can't risk your life. We can't risk your stability. We can't risk your future. We love you too much to do that to you. We aren't afraid of going back to our country, but y'all need to be here. I promise you will understand it later, even though you don't understand it right now. But this is what love looks like. And as we drove the four hours back to Baton Rouge, I sat in the minivan, disappointed and confused by a decision Rhea supposedly made in love. Is this what love looks like? I think when we turn into our gospel text this morning, we find Jesus' disciples in a very similar place. Perhaps not in the back of a 99 Plymouth Voyager, and instead in an upper room on the west side of Jerusalem, Jesus has told them that he has made a decision in love. And they really don't see it. They really don't get it. We read only verses 31 through 38, but to really understand what's happening here, we have to make sense of the whole 13th chapter of John. the farewell chapter, the farewell meal and discourse begins here. Other gospels call it the Last Supper, but John is a little different. So it's the farewell meal. So he ate with them, and then after eating, the story tells us that he gets up from the table, takes off his outer garment, washes his disciples' feet, and as he washes their feet, Peter resists. Lord, you cannot wash my feet. But Jesus responds, I must wash your feet. So then Peter says, my hands and my head too. And Jesus says, wait, don't get carried away. Y'all can laugh. And then after he does that, he tells them why he did it. He said, I'm doing this to try to set an example for you, to show you love, to show you how to treat one another. He says that I will suffer and I will die. I will be betrayed and all of you will desert and abandon me. I will die a death on the cross. And so the last thing that I want to teach y'all is how to love one another. And then he goes a bit further. He says that if you have to boil down all the 613 laws, all the 10 commandments, boil it down to one thing, all you have to do is love one another. Just as Jesus says that he loves. But the disciples still don't get it. In fact, they resist his final teaching. They ask, wait, who is going to betray you? And where are you going? And why can't we go in there with you? And what's up with all this dark image and morbid language in the first place? What are you getting at, Jesus? What do you mean you have to suffer and die? And where are you going again? And why can't we go there with you? And as if those questions aren't enough, Peter takes it a step further. He actually says, in fact, Jesus, you can't go anywhere without me. If you can handle it, Jesus, I can also handle it. He swears on his life that he gets it. He swears that he understands the call to follow Jesus, the love that Jesus is talking about. He has this grand show, but yet he's clueless, actually, to what Jesus is up to. How often are we like Peter and the other disciples, clueless to what Jesus is up to? How often are we asking Jesus over and over and over and over again, wait, where are you going and why do you have to go there and why did this have to happen? How often do we arrogantly declare to Jesus that we understand exactly what he's talking about and that we're done listening to the same thing over and over and over again? I've heard the gospel of liberation already. I don't need to hear that every week. How often does Jesus respond? I have to suffer and die because I love these people. How often does Jesus try to get the disciples to understand what his life is really, really about? See, my friends, I love you all, and I love this church, and I love church history, but please let me be clear. Please don't miss this. Most of us are clueless about what Jesus is really up to in the world. The disciples were clueless until they started to do what Jesus did. Then they understood it a little better. Oh, this is why you have to suffer, Jesus. Because you're telling the truth about the world, and the world isn't going to like that. most of us are clueless about what Jesus is up to. It was true in church history, and it is true today. Christians have gotten it wrong and completely miss it. Church leaders get it wrong and we completely miss it. We don't understand what Jesus is up to when we disregarded the practice of slavery and segregation, and nobody raised a moral voice about it, or shall I say, not enough people raised a moral voice about it. See, even with all the records that we have of the mistakes of other Christians in the past, even with all the efforts of some small groups of people to reform it, we still don't really get what this work is ultimately about. We still stray really, really, really far away from this one commandment that Jesus tried to give his disciples, to love one another as he has loved us. We don't get it. And I know we don't get it because we still fight about the essence of Christian life, Tim. We struggle over the meaning of faith. As a collective Christian body, we have not largely accepted that our primary task is to love by liberating. That our primary job is to work to eliminate the suffering of those people around us and on the margins. We still have not grasped, Rhea, that our vocation, our calling, the life that we have together has to be staked in justice and love. Love in public is justice. Not enough of us accept that being a Christian, being a follower of Jesus, is about preparing ourselves to love a world that is difficult to love. I hope y'all are hearing me. I know I'm saying something. We're a small group, but I hope y'all feel the energy that being a Christian is about preparing ourselves to love a world that will ultimately reject us when they find out that we are about God's work of liberation. Friends, do you see that? Do you understand what is at stake for the disciples and what is at stake for Jesus? See, it's not that Jesus doesn't want them to join them on the cross. Jesus wants them to understand what type of cross they're getting themselves into. Jesus desperately wants community. He wants his imam there, Alabama. He wants his rabbi there when he's on the cross. He wants Peter to claim him publicly. But more important than all of that, Jesus wants them to fully understand what following him means. Jesus wants them to fully prepare themselves to be his disciples, to see the structures they have to work against, all the theology they have to deconstruct, all of the family members they have to have conversations with, all of the jobs they probably have to turn down because it would make them deal in death, all of the institutions and ceremonies they would have to lose faith in. Jesus wants them to see that and then say, I want to follow you. See, Jesus is unrelenting in his teaching that the things that are great and hairy, new challenges would emerge, new groups would emerge, new voices would emerge, new images of liberation would emerge. But what would stay the same is this love ethic. That if we listen to the voices of people who struggle, listen to those who talk about their pain, listen to those who are asking for mercy, who come out as dreamers, who say, me too. Jesus is pressing his disciples to use love as their ethic to live in the world. See, the beautiful thing about this love commandment is that it anticipates the social changes and still gives us a guide for how to live in them. People always accuse religious progressives of being cool with anything. Anything goes, they say. You just let people do whatever they want, but they fundamentally miss that everything does not, in fact, go. Things that do not love and do not liberate do not get to go. See, Jesus knew that he didn't have time to learn every policy or know every move, but he said, let me just give you this standard. Does it promote love and liberation or does it not? That's how you know where to take your stances. And it's amazing how this question will truly change your life. It's amazing the places of struggle that you will find yourself in. I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana this week with my Liberian parents having a conversation about gender nonconformity. That's where it takes us. Appealing to them, advocating for that. Where might it take you? You will hear the voice of God, see the face of God in people you've never expected to. But yet still, we stand 2,000 years removed from Jesus in a nation comprised of a lot of Christians. And we see why he spoke so harshly to Peter and the other disciples. They had not prepared themselves to understand what he was talking about. And Jeremy, neither have we. As our denomination still deliberate if queer people can serve as clergy, it is clear that we don't know what Jesus is up to. As church leaders are determined to bring us back into the dark ages where they proclaim that women's voices are not legitimate in the pulpit, it is clear that we don't know what Jesus is up to. As Christian theology and so-called Christian ethics and Christian churches and Christian politicians running on Christian platforms and so-called Christian principles enact laws in Alabama, Georgia, Missouri, and Ohio, and has legislation pending in Louisiana and Texas trying to end a woman's right to choose, we don't know what Jesus is up to. I'm sorry. Every time we overlook stories of actual people that exist with actual hardship and actual pain and actual suffering and ignore those voices, we don't know what Jesus is really up to. See, these same politicians who enact these laws never speak about black life, never speak about queer life, never speak about working poor life or undocumented life or children's killed in school life or strung up on drugs and in jail life because the system has pushed your life against the wall and they claim to be pro-life? What? We have no clue what Jesus is up to. But the beauty in this text, I'm almost done. The beauty in this text is that Jesus doesn't actually leave us clueless. He offers his life up for us, and he loves us so that we can learn from him. He gives us resources to better see what he is up to. He wants us to see, as one commentator puts it, that this text is about love for the people inside the community. And that's part of why the disciples resisted. They resisted because that seems obvious to them. I know how to love the other disciples. No, they don't. They think they already get it, but they don't. They miss it. The dynamics of their community are way more complex than they are willing to admit. They think that Judas is the only one who betrayed Jesus, and that's not the case. All of them betray Jesus. Jesus is left there alone. On the cross, by himself. They overlook the ways that they have betrayed Jesus. They overlook their responsibility in the sin, their culpability in the injustice in Calvary. My question for you, too, is do you see the ways we betray Jesus, too? Do you see the ways that we are complicit in the injustice in the world? Do you see the ways in which we promote bad theology? Do you see the ways that white supremacy still has a stronghold on our church? See, James Cone confronts us with this theological problem in his book, said, I wasn't going to tell nobody. He writes, I felt that white liberals had killed Martin Luther King Jr. Sure, no, they didn't pull the trigger, but so many people thought he was moving too fast and they refused to listen to his judgment on America for failing to deal with the great evils of poverty, militarism, and racism. The white liberal media demonized King every day for opposing Vietnam, asking, what does a preacher know about foreign affairs? They blamed him for the violence that followed him. And Cohn says that he feels like they were a big part of the problem. They provided the cone that allowed for King's character to be assassinated. And so he says they took no responsibility for King's murder. They refused to understand why Negroes were rioting in the streets and burning down their communities. They refused to accept any responsibility. They refused to see any complicity. And we risked that too. Trump's America isn't that far apart from ours. We have some responsibility in it. True, we don't believe all of those things or vote for all of those things, but we have loved ones in our community. We have people around us who do, and we have not confronted them in love about those things. We have not held enough of them accountable for the effects of those beliefs. See, I am convinced that one of the main reasons I ask a church like ours to do liberation theology every single week is so we can acknowledge our responsibility, our culpability in the deplorableness of the condition. We don't get to be that different from other types of Christians just by saying we are. We have to do the work every single day. We have to love all of Christianity and love it enough to argue with it, to challenge it, to condemn it when it falls short of the love command. We cannot live aloof from the trends and dominant practices of other Christianities. We must struggle over it. We must struggle with it, correct it, challenge it, deconstruct it. We must write a new narrative about it. We cannot exist on a theological and an ecclesial island indifferent of how our religion is causing harm in the world. We can't think that the work is done simply by being here. No, we must be a part of the struggle. And those stakes are high, and the betrayal is coming from within the community. It's Christians that aren't loving that are producing violence in our public policy. And we're not free to walk away from them. Judas and Peter all share the community with us. And that is precisely why Jesus is trying to say, the thing that I need you to know is that you have to love one another, because the dynamics of the world are in this room. Will you love your neighbors? Will you help them to prioritize love? Will you help them to understand the suffering, to understand the violence, to understand the pain, to understand the expansive nature of political oppression? Will you help them to see the theological and ontological terror? Will you help them to hear the sounds of the heartbreaks? Will you help them to see the human condition further colored and exacerbated by race, class, gender, sexual orientation, nationality, access to healthcare, the real life, everyday struggles of people being rejected by immigration judges, of children turning 16 and not being able to travel, or 18 and not being able to get student loans, of parents fearful to move because of ICE, of Black folks fearful to move because their lives might result in death, of women who feel as though they're losing control of their body. Do you see that? And do you love anybody enough to say that and stand in solidarity with them? I hope y'all hear me. This is what is at stake for Jesus. This is why he teaches them this. See, the people that we love, the people that we ought to love, are people that we shouldn't be afraid of. Look, all of us were probably formed in faith communities outside of this one. All of us are connected to people and connected to families and connected to nations and societies and values and ideas that need to be re-examined through a lens of liberation and love. And what Jesus is saying is, at the end of the day, if you really want to be my follower, if you really want to go the places that I am going, if you really want to know what I'm up to, you must see the world through a new lens of love. You must examine your community and recognize the sins of your community. You must examine the church and recognize the sin of the church. And you must see that we too have betrayed Jesus. And you must commit to working to repair that breach, to restore that divide, to offer repentance for those sins, reparations for that harm, so that before the rooster crows, we all might really be able to actually really say that we really know what Jesus is up to and want to be up to it.